Hi, everyone. Welcome to Key Change, a COC podcast, where we explore everything about opera from a fresh perspective.
We're your hosts, Robin Grant Moran
and Julie McIsaac.
Today on the show, we're looking at what many music lovers consider a perfect opera, The Marriage of Figaro by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
The opera is set in a household led by the wealthy Count Almaviva. There's his wife, the Countess Rosina, and a whole team of staff, including the title character Figaro and his soon-to-be wife Susanna, who the Count not so secretly wants for himself.
The opera was written as satire, poking fun at the foibles of the upper classes, and can be staged with lots of playful physical comedy. But the production we're talking about today doesn't rely so much on slapstick and gags as it does on a stylized psychological journey. The humor here is a lot drier, and the overall look is quite monochromatic, creating a more somber tone. When it showed last in Toronto in 2016, Now magazine had this to say: "You'll probably never see a darker version of Mozart's comic opera, The Marriage of Figaro, than that staged by director Klaus Guth."
So when we were thinking about someone we could talk to with a good handle on how this production compares to others, the first person that came to mind was bass baritone Luca Pizzaroni.
Luca was born in Venezuela and moved to Busseto, Italy, when he was 4. He says he's loved opera from a very young age, which is hard not to do when you live in Verdi's hometown.
Luca is well known for his performance of Mozart operas, and Figaro has become a signature role for him.
Non cadrai farfallone amoroso, notte giorno d'intorno girando, delle belle trovando riposo, narcisetto adocino d'amor.
He sung it everywhere from the Met, the Salzburg Festival, Paris Opera, Vienna, and Munich, more than 17 different productions, according to his recollections.
It also was the role in which he made his professional debut. But maybe don't ask him about his first Figaro. He says it makes him feel old.
Having been in this specific production before, Luca actually has a different take on its overall vibe. But we'll get to that in just a moment.
We began by asking Luca what gets him excited to become this character and perform in this opera time and time again.
Every time I perform any opera, to be honest with you, I approach it like it's the last thing I do in my life. So I never get bored. And there is something I think which is unique to Mozart music, is that every time you look at the score or you can find new details. And this is what keeps me going. So every time I rehearse or I do a musical rehearsal or an orchestra rehearsal, I'll try to find a new angle or a new color for how I say thing or how I sing. And that's why it keeps my job very interesting. And I am happy to come back to this great character that is Figaro.
We'd love to hear, Luca, about your very first Figaro, like what that preparation looked like and how that has evolved since, now that you've sung it so many times, and what are the different dimensions, perhaps, that you now find in the character compared to that very first time that you sang it.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it because it was a long time ago. My first Figaro was actually in 2001. In Klagenfurt, of all places in Austria. And I remember I did an audition when I was still a student at the conservatory, and they actually asked me to sing it. And I remember I was completely unprepared. And funny enough, I actually have a little video of me performing Non più andrai, Farfallone amoroso, and I watched it something like 5 years ago. And I remember I was like, oh my God, what was I thinking? And it's interesting because at that time I thought I knew the role a little bit. And the more I sang it, the more, and the older I got, the more you realize that there is so much more to the character, right? Because when you are young, you think about the energy that he has, the fact that he's, you know, this, this sparkling character that comes in and, you know, and he has brilliant ideas. And the older I got, the more, like, for example, I got connected to the last act about when he thinks he's been betrayed. And so there is the aria that I don't think is a scene where he screams against women. It's like he's venting just because he's hurt. And then there is the most beautiful line, which is Tutto tranquillo e placido, where I think Mozart in like six bars told us what an unbelievable composer he is. So it's interesting to see throughout all the production I've done how, you know, getting older affects my interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Also lovely to think about how you, as you age, you can carry the character along with you and find those different dimensions within it. So you can grow within the same character.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, like, if I think of my earlier Figaro, it was like all energy. I would come in, it would be a little tornado, you know, on stage. And now that I am slightly older, I go, I think I can walk instead of running. But it's not because, you know, it's just because you find a different color and you realize that the amazing thing about Nozze di Figaro for me is a story that you can tell over and over again and everybody can connect to it, which makes it so such a masterpiece because everybody in the audience can have a moment of reflection of their own life through what they are seeing.
This Klaus Guth production is a much drier and darker take than a lot of the more hijinks-style presentations you might associate with a comedic opera. How does the director's vision for staging and tone affect your work as an artist?
You know, I don't completely agree with the statement that it's a much darker reading of the opera. You know, I'm European and I live in Vienna, which is a little bit of a darker city, probably. And we managed to find some kind of humor in every tragedy and a little bit of tragedy in every comedy. So I really can relate to this production. And the first time I did it, I saw it in 2006 because it was premiered by Nicolaus Annaucourt, Ildebrando d'Arcangelo, and Anna Netrebko. And I saw it on TV and I liked it. But when I got to do it and I got to talk to Klaus about this, I loved it because it is such a phenomenal reading about, you know, it's a little bit of a take of what can we do as human and what is actually our destiny. And the fact that he has introduced the character, which is Cherubin, you know, it's like a spirit that moves a little bit everybody around, tells me that we have our own destiny, but we have our own determination and we make our choices, but there is a little bit of destiny and we cannot escape it. And so I don't see it as a dark reading of the piece. I see more like it's a much more psychological reading where you see what's going on in everybody's head. And I love it because it allows you to go so much deeper in what we say and what we do on stage. And it's not just this, you know, superficial comedy, but it makes you think much more about who we are as human beings and why we do things. And why we suffer and why we love and why we are jealous And I just love that production. Mm. And I cannot wait to do it again, because I had such a good time. And I remember when we were working on it, and he would tell me his thought, I would go, oh my God, I didn't understand that. But then if you want this, I can try to do that. And he said to me, oh yeah, good, good. And it tells you that it's always good to go back to a production, because the second time you do, you understand so much more of what you want to do and tell. And I love him because he always has this humor, but it's a very dry humor, which is my kind of humor. You know, you need to be Martin Kuge, which is a German director, told me you need to be very serious to make people laugh. And I never, you know what I mean? I never thought about it, but it's absolutely true. You need to take your character incredibly serious, and then the situation makes people laugh, not you, because you are trying to be a buffoon, which is a hard work. And so I can't wait to be back. Cannot wait.
Hearing you speak about the Klaus Gut production, is there a particular moment or scene that you're looking forward to getting back to? Is there something in all of Figaro's material that you're thinking, oh, I can't wait to get that, to get a second try at that scene?
Look, there are so many amazing moments. The beginning, for example, when he's measuring, and he's not actually measuring. He's like doing his gesture with the hands. Why? Because he said to me, it's all in his head. And he's, you know, it's very hard in opera to show certain things, because we are not like a movie where somebody can speak and tell you, and you understand that he's thinking instead of actually saying it. So in opera, you have to find a way to say, actually, this is my own thought, and you are listening to what I'm thinking. And so, for example, the beginning, for example, the finale primo, where there are all the names of the characters and all the connection between them. The last act, which is a mixture of a dream and a nightmare, and I don't know, there are so many. I have such good memories of this production. It was in 2007 in Salzburg, and I had wonderful colleagues. I had Jerry Finley as a count. I had Dorothea Röschmann as a contessa. I had Diana Damrau as my Susanna. So I have amazing memories of this. And Daniel Harding was conducting. So it was like one of the summer where we say in our job, you know, that is either a good production or is good musically or is a good cast. And that summer, it was like everything together. Great production, great conductor, great cast is one of the things that really I remember of my career.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm certainly getting very excited for this production to return, hearing you speak about it. And now, in terms of other productions of Figaro that you've done, we'd love to know, are there any other particularly memorable productions or unusual productions of The Marriage of Figaro that you've been a part of?
I've done so many throughout my career. And I don't tell you how many, because it would be quite... it would reveal that I am not as young as I pretend to be. And I've done almost 160 performances of the role in, I think, is 17 different productions. And I have a couple that they have a really special place in my heart. One is the one of David Mayvicar at Royal Opera House in London, which was a little bit like a take on Downton Abbey. And I loved it. I loved the production that I recently did at the Paris Opera, because it was a very dry take. And I like it because, you know, sometimes we try as a performing opera performance to convince young people to come because it's cool. But then you see on stage somehow a little bit of old-fashioned acting. And in this production in Paris by Nisha Jones, she really cut us to the bare minimum with very little gesture, and it looked really like any TV show that you could see on TV today. And that's why it was such a big success. The thing about the production for me is that it's not important if it has a modern look or an old look, quote unquote. It's just that you need to work on the relationship between the characters. If these are developed, then I am a happy puppy. I did a great production of Jonathan Miller at the Met, and it was really old-fashioned. But the persona regie, the character attitude and relationship were so well developed that it was so modern. So I'm always, you know, I always go for, okay, tell me who I am, where I'm supposed to go, and let's try to show the, you know, the journey that my character is having throughout these 3.5 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's really lovely to consider that even if something's an old story or if the concept for the production looks old, quote unquote, like you said, that if the relationships are really clear and well developed, that it feels new or it feels resonant for us here and now.
Because, I mean, if you think about it, TV shows, it's all like old stories like Game of Thrones and Downton Abbey. But then opera is like, oh, it's old fashioned. It's like, no, it's not old fashioned. It's cool. It's cool. And we, you know, and we actually managed to make something that has been written such a long time ago, still relevant to us today, which I think it shows how such what a masterpiece this is. Mm-hmm. When you manage to have something that was written 250 years ago and still connect to it. I mean, that's amazing. So I'm all like, I'm fighting very, very hard. Very, very hard. I'm a baby in my spirit about this. A baby.
Now, in addition, Luca, to being very excited to have you at the COC to sing Figaro, we looked at your upcoming performance schedule and we were thrilled to see the return of the No Tenors Allowed concert. Now, this is a recital concert in which you collaborate with baritone Thomas Hampson, who happens to be your father-in-law, and who COC audiences might recall as Hadrian in the world premiere presentation of the opera of that same name in 2018. So we'd love to know, what was the inspiration for the No Tenors Allowed concert and for the title in particular?
Oh, this everybody knows it. Thomas recorded a CD titled No Tenors Allowed with Sam Raimi in the 90s, late 90s, I believe. And they never managed to tour it because they were both incredibly busy. So it happens, Summer Festival in Austria asked us to do a concert and we said, why not? And then we tried to find some repertoire. And from that moment on, we said, oh, this is actually fun and we can do Puritani, Don Carlo, Don Pasquale, Macbeth, we can do Attila. And from that moment on, we offered it and a lot of people responded to it. And I tell you, it's fun because, first of all, the repertoire is very interesting. It's normally not a repertoire that you hear in a concert. Normally you hear a soprano, a tenor, and hear all the duets that they have from Tosca, Bohème. And so the repertoire is really interesting. And I have to say, Thomas and I have a very good chemistry on stage. And I think audiences respond to that. And it's been like this since the first day we worked together, which was in 2002 in Salzburg. I was his Mazzetto. And when he was singing Don Giovanni, and you know, we liked each other from the very beginning, and I always was attracted to his serious approach to music. The fact that we are not entertaining; we are telling stories, and you know, let alone that he's a phenomenal singer. But I was really. For me, being an opera singer is not just entertain somebody, it's actually, you know, helping somebody go through a tough time because it can connect to what I say in a piece. Or, yes, make him laugh in a moment where he's down. So I think we have a much higher responsibility than we think. And there is nothing better for me to do something profoundly touching on stage and see that the audience reacts to it, or make a joke on stage, do something funny, and hear 3,000 people laughing. There's nothing better than that. So when we are on stage, we really play off each other, and people can see that, and I think they enjoy it.
So with the no tenors allowed, I just love that so much because everything is tenor. And so to have a show that is entirely baritone repertoire is just, chef's kiss, beautiful.
We bass baritones and baritone need therapy because we all want to be tenors. And unfortunately, we are trapped in these bodies. And that's why I think the tenors are doing just fine. It's our problem. You know, it's like when you're in a relationship, they say, it's not you, honey, it's me. Well, in this case, it's definitely us. It's nothing to do with tenors. It's more that the tenor has this romantic role. Right. And he gets to be in love and he gets to show, you know, this emotion, when we are more like the element that disturbs the peace and the love between the soprano and the tenor, right? Mm-hmm. And this mm-hmm. is what frustrates us, a little bit, because we would love to also to be able to sing a romantic aria where we talk about mm-hmm. our feelings. Instead, most of the time, it we don't get to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why. You know, that's why our jealousy about tenors.
So that brings the question up in my mind of, like, a subversion in the art form of opera and breaking those norms. So I'm curious about, for you, like, do you think there are other things at Figaro that should be subverted or expectations changed, the industry in general? Like, should we be writing operas with romantic baritone leads? You know, what is it that you would like to see?
Well, before we go there, I have to say, I would like to see opera a little bit more through a female perspective, in the sense that I do not particularly agree when everybody says, sopranos are, in love and they is a patriarchal society mm-hmm. and they just do as told. Actually, I think opera is so contemporary. Most of the soprano roles are such incredibly courageous women. And mm-hmm. actually, most of them, they try to break the rules and the cage the society put them in, and to prove that, I am, the owner of my own destiny. So I think we need to work, before we talk about, bass baritone being, Mario Cavaradossi, I think we need to work on that, because there is so much more to explore, in my opinion. Because if you look at Traviata, a woman that says, I don't care what society said, this is how I want to live my life. And then the father comes and said, society, and she struggles with that. If you think about Rigoletto, Gilda, that despite the fact that the father tries to keep her in a cage, comes back and said, I love my man and I'm ready, to do whatever it takes to live my love for him. There are so many situations. Don Elvira, I'm doing Don Giovanni now. Don Elvira at the time travels alone to, fight for her love. I think it's amazing. And I think we are so focused on on other things that we miss a little bit this part of our you know of opera. You know, it there is much more to the female empowerment that I think we give them credit of.
It's really easy to get caught up in the woman gets punished element in the operas when you do have to remember that, in fact, Violetta, Donna Elvira, that they do have some level of agency and they do have passions.
Absolutely.
And a life of their own.
And, you know, for example, for me, it was very interesting to do this Nozze di Figaro in Paris with a female director, because I think it was my first time to have a female director for this opera. And it's interesting to see, you know, the perspective, you know, and the fact that in that piece, the male characters don't look that great. You know, don't look that great. The Count doesn't look that great. Even Figaro, you know, when he doubts, you know, Susanna, as a moment where he's like, you know, I think honestly we need to hear different voices, because it's going to help us, I think, find new layers and new way to explore a piece, right? Because mm-hmm. I think the music, it's so it's so transcendental that anybody can find a message in it, and I want to hear as many messages as possible.
Mm. Yeah, Luca, I really appreciate what you're saying about the staging these operas in such a way that we see and celebrate the agency and the courage of these female characters.
Talking about Figaro, without the two women, the opera would end in the middle of Act 3. And it's them, and they are the engine of the piece, you know. And so I think you need to celebrate this and say, can you imagine? And this you have to give credit to Mozart, that at that time, he still thought, you know, women were not like a nice vase to put somewhere, to, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they were the engine of society, and they always have been. And so I'm happy to celebrate that. And I think it's very important, because I think this competition is absolutely stupid. And I think it's only if we, you know, we are on this journey together. So if we actually respect each other and help each other, things are going to be much better. That's my opinion.
Well, and in terms of the possibilities of opera, we know, Luca, that you are a peace ambassador for the international nonprofit organization Opera for Peace, which promotes unity through artistic excellence, global collaborations, and social justice endeavors. So could you speak a little bit about your work with Opera for Peace?
I always say that if we made music mandatory for a couple of years for everybody would get along much better, because putting an opera together, it's an act of love, and you need to be listening to other people, and you need to put yourself in somebody else, and you need to learn how to collaborate. And I think if everybody did that for 2 years, the world would be a much better place. And I like this initiative, because I think opera can give you the tools to become a better human being, not only because opera talk about human feelings and the human experience on this earth, but also because to put together such a mammoth enterprise, which is opera, takes so much effort. You know, I have to be responsible for my lines, and yet I need to know what the others are saying in case somebody forgets. And I need to pay attention about the lighting, and I need to pay attention about the set, and I need to understand what the conductor wants. I need to understand what the director wants, working with all the people backstage. This takes so much work. And you know, one director told me that the problem of opera is that we're so worried about the future and what comes next, right? You are singing a line and then he says, hey, my next line is going to be this. He said, the secret is just listen. And this has changed the way I act, because obviously if you listen and it gives you time to understand what somebody says, and once you understand it, then you can react. And you react like it's the first time you hear it, which makes it so alive, and people see it like it's being created in that moment. So I love this initiative because it's really what, you know, living in a society is all about. And I think opera can have a very good part of it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Robin, you mentioned earlier that you had a little guest perhaps joining you.
Yeah, so my little opera dog, who is sleeping behind me right now, we were wondering about your opera dogs. And we will link to their website in our show notes. It is a beautiful collection of photographs. We're wondering if they're traveling with you and if we'll see them in Toronto.
Yeah, they are traveling with me all the time. So opera dogs as Lenny, is a golden retriever, and Tristan, a miniature dachshund. And they are with me all the time. And they are definitely coming to Toronto. They were there last time I was there. And they are definitely coming in January, February, 2023. There is nothing I can say about my dogs because, you know, it's they are more famous than I am. So what do you want me to say about it? You know, it's interesting that you know, after a show, most of the time, you know, fans come and say, great job, where are the dogs? You know, it's just, I feel like it's getting right to the edge where I'm like, I'm getting jealous a little bit. You know, it's like I've been singing for 3.5 hours, you know. But I mean, jokes aside, I think they are the best. You know, they are the best. I love having my companions here. You know, there is nothing better, for example, to go for a morning walk before a rehearsal to wake up. There is nothing better for me after a show to walk them at midnight, 1 a.m. when there is almost nobody on the street. And it gives you time to, you know, evaluate your performance and you know, enjoy the fact that, you know, I get to sing, which is something amazing. Mm. You know, I'm really grateful for them. Really, really mm-hmm. grateful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of gratitude, Luca, I know so many of us have had our perspectives and priorities changed and challenged throughout the pandemic. And now sort of we're seeing things with fresh eyes and listening with fresh ears. And now that you're back into the rhythm of travel and rehearsal and production, we'd be curious to know if you felt any shifts in yourself when it comes to your feelings or your gratitude around what it is that you do for a living and live performance in particular.
Look, I have to say, I had a mental breakdown in 2020. I mean, I was paralyzed for a couple of months, literally paralyzed. I didn't know what to do because unfortunately, what I do is what defines me. It's impossible for me to separate who I am as a person to what I do because, you know, being an opera singer is not a profession. It's in Italiano we say vocazione, which I think is like a vocation. It's like, you know, it is a reason for me to be on this planet. You know, I miss the rehearsals time. I miss to be on stage. I miss the contact with the audience. And I tell you, it's not about applause by any means. And in fact, if you ask, I hate applauses. It's the more I'm so uncomfortable because I'm a shy person. So for me, it's a little bit like I'm a little bit naked on stage. But what I love is to be somebody else on stage, to forget about me and try to tell somebody else's story. And this is what I think is absolutely unbelievable about the job that I do, that I get to be somebody else and I get to be to experience somebody else's feelings and to try to understand the human experience of somebody else, which is a gift because it gives you a much better understanding that everybody is struggling somehow, and we need to be respectful of this, and we need to be gentle because we don't know what somebody else is going through. And so the first 2 months, I was like a disaster. And then I started physical labor. And so I really worked to almost to myself to sleep. I worked so hard that I didn't have any time to think. And so I would, you know, get up, work, and go to bed because I was physically destroyed. And I have to say to you the truth that it has not changed much my relationship with my work, because I take every performance like it's my last one, and I take every engagement like it's the last one, because I know that I won the lottery. And so I never took this for granted. Never. Not even a second. You can ask my colleagues. They think I'm a little bit too intense because there is, you know, I don't like a note that I sing in the rehearsal and I go, oh, that's it. It's over. My career is over. I don't know how to sing anymore, you know, because it means so much to me to be able to do this that I never took this for granted. Not a second of it. So that's my experience.
It was really great being able to chat with Luca.
You know, I love his carpe diem approach to performance, the idea of going out there and singing and telling the story as though it's the very last time.
It's such a great reminder for just how to live.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And yeah, it connects, I think, to that advice that he says he tries to remember about not worrying about what comes next, but just listening. And I feel like that's something we can all take forward, to just try to be in the moment and really listen to each other as though this moment is all mm-hmm. there is.
I really loved how he talked about the women in the operas. You know, it's so easy to look at everything through our current lens and thank God things have changed. And these behaviors, it is not okay to have servants and it is not okay to abuse your servants. But the recognition that these women are in fact very powerful. They're the interesting characters. They're the backbone of the story. And to hear that from someone who often plays the more scheming or gets to abuse women, that he really appreciates the women. I don't know. That was just a really lovely thing for me. Also, I just really love his dogs and that he travels with them. I think that's so great.
So great. And just remember that if you chat with Luca after a show, give him all of the well-deserved attention before turning your attention to those dogs.
Before you ask about the dogs.
Luca and his famous dogs will be in Toronto this winter. You can catch him on stage in The Marriage of Figaro, January 27th to February 18th at the Four Seasons Centre for the Performing Arts. For full details and ticket info, check out coc.ca. Next time, we'll be delving into one of the most shocking operas in history, Zalome by Richard Strauss.
In the COC's upcoming production, the title role will be sung by Canadian soprano Amber Braid. Amber is a graduate of the company's professional development program, the COC Ensemble Studio. Since then, she's become an internationally celebrated singer who's already racked up accolades for this role when she performed it in Frankfurt. So it'll be a real treat for Toronto audiences to experience her take on Zalome this season.
We'll talk to Amber about the challenges of such a psychologically intense storyline, and also a little bit about how she unplugs from a hectic stage life. Here's a hint. If you're looking for a real farm-to-table experience, look no further than Dinner at Her Place.
Thank you again for listening to and for supporting Key Change, a COC podcast. Just a reminder, we love hearing your questions and feedback. Tag us on social at Canadian Opera or email us at audiences@coc.ca.
You can also send us a voice memo. There's instructions for how to do that at coc.ca/keychange. We really appreciate all the feedback we've received so far and the reviews you've left on Apple Podcasts.
Thanks again for joining us on episode 19.
Until next time.
Be the first to find out about free events and concerts from the COC by signing up for our monthly e-opera newsletter at coc.ca/eopera.
Thank you to all of our supporters for making Key Change possible. This week, we want to especially thank every COC member, subscriber, and donor for coming on this journey with us as we explore new ways to share opera's unique power.
So to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe to Key Change, wherever you get your podcasts.
Key Change is produced by the Canadian Opera Company and hosted by Robin Grant Moran and Julie McIsaac.
To learn more about today's guests and see the show notes, please visit our website at coc.ca/keychange.